You got one. Wonderful. Wonderful. Thanks, Juan. Okay, so I'm going to be a little loose about these results. I don't want to take the time to prove them. They're neat things, and they're not too hard. But we talked about it last time. The covering group of a Lie group is it's one with the same Lie algebra, so it has the same dimension as the Lie group, but it's a simply connected manifold. And it turns out that every other Lie group with the same Lie algebra is a quotient of the covering group by some discrete subgroup. So that's the theorem we really want. Be the covering group for the given algebra, then if G is a Lie group with the same Lie algebra, I think I've said that intensively now. we have a group, we find this Lie algebra, we find the covering group that has that same Lie algebra. Then the original group is the quotient of that covering group by a discrete subgroup of the covering group. For example, the orthogonal group O3 has a discrete subgroup plus or minus 1 given by taking the determinant of the matrix. If we take the quotient of O3 by that two-dimensional discrete subgroup, we get SO3. There's a non-trivial example that we have seen part of, and it's important to the idea of spinners. We looked at SO3 and we looked at SU2. Let's take a little bit closer look at those. SU2 and SO3. Remember the Lie algebra. The Lie algebra of SO3 is given by the commutators of the generators. So these were some anti-symmetric matrices, and we found that their commutators, was there a factor of 2? No, it comes out just this way. J sub K. So that's the Lie algebra of SO3. Now look at SU2. Have we looked at SU2? Did we find the Lie algebra of SU2?
We did
SL2C. We did SL2C, right. I'm not sure whether we did it. I may have left it for a problem, since no one going to turn into any problems except Nathan.
I'll turn the book. Where are you on the problems one? Have you worked out that differential forms problem?
Okay. I know you're working on it. Neil was saying he's struggling with them too. If you two guys want to get together sometime and do a little work session, work through a few problems, I'd be fine with that. Anyone else is welcome.
What's good timing?
I don't know. Have any time like Wednesday morning?
The closest time would be right after, or like an hour earlier than this.
Morning. Yeah, I have a little time then. We could meet then for 20 minutes, sort of between me getting back from lunch and before this class. Maybe we could just do it that way. Just do a problem a day or something. Just help you along with it.
I may have to come by other times because my schedule is around.
Do you have any time after class? Yeah, but I can stay as long as you want after class. Do you have time then, Neil? O'Neill is the end of schedule.
Yes. Tentatively, today I do, Friday I have an appointment at 4.
Depends.
All of the other days I work.
Yeah, okay.
So, what do you want to do after class today?
Maybe we can stay and do a little bit. Yeah. And we can take it if you need it. If you're working on
a question about those. Are they all the same? A different number of dimensions, will they look different, like a different order?
That's a good question, because for some of those,
might switch order.
V of a function is the gradient in any dimension. But, what did we say?
We're doing some three dimensions, though.
There were a lot of three-dimensional examples. Like the cross product doesn't exist in any but three dimensions, for example. The cross product, you can take the wedge product of two one-forms, and if you take the dual of that, the wedge product of two one-forms is a two-form. The dual of that in n dimensions is an n minus 2 form. Well, if n is 3, the dual n minus 2 is 1, and you're back to a vector. So you have this anti-symmetric wedge product turning back into a vector only in 3 dimensions. So the cross product is something that's very special to that dimension. Some things are special to the dimension, some aren't, but D and star and wedge work in any dimension.
But the Laplacian for an arbitrary number of dimensions is going to be different for a 3 versus 4.
There's the Laplacian of a function will be the Laplacian of a function will be the same in any dimension.
Right.
But the Laplacian of a one form or something, it may depend on your definition of the dual. There could be some independence in the fine. Because there are two terms you could have in the Laplacian, and you usually do. If you're taking a Laplacian of a form, then you have to know what the relative sign is between those two terms. And that could depend on dimension. It could depend on the order of the form you're taking the Laplacian of. If you're clever enough with your dimensions, you might avoid some of that, but probably not all of it.
Because we worked out an example. I have a really nice version of that, and then I tried to do a different dimension. We worked out the case of the function, and then I tried to do that with the form, and it seemed like
The order
is different. Instead of being something like star D, star D, it was like D star, D star.
Well, yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, on forms you need both of them. The only things that have two derivatives and, map P forms to P forms. So this will always take a P form to a P form because D takes it to a P plus 1, star takes it to N minus D plus 1, another D takes it to that plus 1, and then star takes it to N minus all of that, which is, I don't know what that is, let's see, N minus N plus P plus 1 minus 1, so P. So it takes a P form to a P form. Well, D star also takes a P form to a P form. Because star takes it to an N minus P form. D takes that to N minus P plus 1. The second star takes you to N minus all of that. And one more D adds to 1. So we have N minus N plus P minus 1 plus 1 is P. Now, on a function...
Is there any place where it's N plus 1 and then it ends up killing it?
On a function here, yeah. This one kills a function always.
Okay.
Because star takes you to an N form and D takes you to an N plus 1 form, which is different.
Right, so it's different on a function than a form.
So for a Laplace, for the Laplacian of a function, it's only this term and you're done. All it can be. But for the Laplacian of any other form, a 1 form, 2 form, 3 form, whatever, it's some combination of the two. And you have to figure out what the combination is. And there, the sign depends on whether you're taking the Laplacian of a 3 form or a 4 form. At least it could, and I think it usually does. I think it alternates in sign, but I'd have to check. But it's always going to be some combination of those two terms. The relative sign, depending on your definition, could be P and or N dependent. Okay, so that's for sure. Okay, we were looking at the Lie algebra of SU2. And, for problems, you should do everything involving SU2 because, that's spin and quantum mechanics and stuff. And, but anyway, what is SU2? I'm wondering if I want to leave this for you to figure out or not. You want to figure this out? Let's just do it. Let's let G be an element of SU2. Then G dagger equals G inverse. That's what makes it unitary. Let's look at the neighborhood of the identity. So I can write, G of epsilon is the identity plus some small transformation epsilon. And what's required for epsilon is that if I take G dagger G, what's that going to be? 1 plus epsilon dagger times 1 plus epsilon. That's got to be the identity. But to first order, I get 1 plus epsilon dagger plus epsilon, and then I throw out the order epsilon squared. And we see that we have to have epsilon dagger equals minus epsilon. This is true for any unitary group, not just SU2, but any unitary group, the generators are anti-Hermitian. So, to find the group elements, G is the exponential of I times H, right? So if H equals H dagger, then, right, so H is Hermitian, then IH dagger equals minus I times H dagger equals minus IH. So IH is anti-Hermitian. So for many Hermitian matrix, we can make an anti-Hermitian one. Just multiply by I. So the exponential of I times the Hermitian matrix gives you a unitary transformation. You know, whatever dimension you like. Now, for SU2, we need a basis for, we've got another property here. Let's see, for anti-Hermitian matrices. That's easy, because if alpha, beta, mu, nu, dagger equals alpha star, beta star, mu star, nu star, equals, let's see, that needs to be equal to alpha, beta, mu, nu, then we see that alpha equals alpha star, nu equals nu star, and mu equals beta star. So any matrix of the form, a real number here, a real number there, a complex number there, and its complex conjugate, that will be Hermitian. Well, I can write that as a half a plus b plus a half a minus b, 1, and as, let's write this as c minus, let me put the conjugate one up here, that would be u conjugate, c minus I d, c plus I d. And then here, I can write B as 1 half A plus B minus 1 half A minus B. I'm just adding and subtracting the same thing here. But then it takes the form, in terms of real numbers, that's a real number, that's a different real number. So I have E plus F, C minus ID, C plus ID, and E minus F, there. So, four real numbers, C, D, E, F, determine any 2x2 Hermitian matrix. Also, for SU2, we need get G equals the identity, equals 1. How do we guarantee that for the generator? Let's see. How do we? The generator is anti-Hermitian. So, we have G is equal to the identity plus, all right, something of this form. What is it? Let's just write E plus F, C minus ID, C plus ID, and E minus F as our generator. So then the determinant, all right, we're going to have 1 plus E plus F times 1 plus E minus F minus the product of those two, C squared minus D squared. Just add these and take the determinant. But at lowest order, all right, remember we're looking at this only to linear order, so these are about zero. And if I multiply this out, I have 1 plus E plus F plus E minus F plus E squared minus F squared, and I throw those out, and the F cancel nicely, so I get 1 plus 2E to linear order. Then the determinant of G has to be 1, we have to have E equal 0. So, everybody has questions. Did I write something stupid? What happened?
Or,
what's the question?
I'm just backing up over here.
Yeah.
For anti emission, should it be like a minus sign here? Like negative alpha. Overall, minus sign.
Oh. For Hermitian.
Okay.
Yeah. Then I times something like this. Okay, these are Hermitian, so there should have been an I here.
Okay.
All right, good. So let's see, what does that do to all this? All right, there's an I everywhere. I. Okay, and then these will be the plus. So we have I times everything. There's an I here. We still get E equals 0. Okay, thank you. Have I done anything else goofy? Yeah, the thing is, there's a nice basis for Hermitian matrices. What is it? The Pauli matrices, right? This is just the identity plus I times, what do we have? No, I don't have enough space to write it out. So let's just note here that this generator, E plus F, C minus ID, C plus ID, C minus F, is E times the identity plus F times sigma 3 plus C times sigma 1 plus D times sigma 2, which I can write as E times the identity plus the 3 vector C, D, F, dotted into the 3 Pauli matrices like that. Just think of little dot products with the matrix. Much easier way to write this thing is a linear combination of the Pauli matrices.
What's NB again? What is which NB?
N.
Where? NB.
Oh, nota bene. That's Latin for note well.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
Notice.
I see that in the picture, but I don't know what that is.
Yeah. Yeah. If I ever write ZB zum Beispiel, for example. German. Let's see. Yeah, et cetera in German is et so weiter and so further. Et cetera, that's Latin though.
Right. Maybe that's
right. What et cetera mean? The rest.
The rest. I think it's N.
Yeah.
What's et cetera?
The rest.
Yeah, the rest.
The rest.
And the rest. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Is that Spanish too? It's Latin.
Well,
I think it's
Latin.
Yeah, it's
Spanish.
It's just on. It's on. Yes. It's on. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
so generators of FU2. Of FU2.
we have, E is zero. Notice that's just saying that the trace is zero. Okay, so we can say trace of epsilon equals zero. And you see it here, the polymatrices are all traceless.
Oh, did I
add
something in?
Sorry. So, in general, epsilon is going to be some tree vector dotted into really I times the polymatrices. And if we compute, we have done this before, if we compute the commutators of I times the polymatrices, that's going to be minus, let's say, sigma I with sigma j. We're going to have minus the commutator of two polymatrices, which is 2i epsilon I j k sigma k. It gives the third one back with cyclic sign. Now there's a problem. Oh, no, there's not a problem, actually. Let's let tau sub I equal, I think what works here is minus I over 2 times the polymatrices. I just want to choose a slightly different basis than the one we've chosen. My algebra closes here. This is perfectly good, but, you know, I just want to choose minus a half times that and get rid of the 2. So, tau I tau j is equal to, I'm just going to have, 1/4 times the commutator of I sigma I with I sigma j. And we just worked that out. And that's, so it's 1/4 of minus 2 I epsilon I j k sigma k. And I can collect this as epsilon I j k, then the minus 2 over 4 gives a minus a half. We have minus I over 2 sigma k is just tau k. So the commutator of tau I with tau j is epsilon I j k tau k. Now, thinking, where have we seen that before? FO3. End of it.
Oh, right. No.
The names have been changed.
Can you go over the last three lines just doing that?
Sure. I'm just multiplying these by minus a half. So I get a minus a half here, minus a half here, and what quarter there. Let's see. How should I say this? I want to compute the commutator of these. Okay, so that's the same. Substitute minus I over 2 sigma I here. Well, if I pull out the minus 1/2 from each of these, I get the quarter. Now, for the commutator of I sigma I and I sigma k, I just worked it out here.
Why don't you get a half? It doesn't factor out it. They multiply.
A half from where? From this?
Yeah, each of those is over 2.
That's where the quarter comes from.
It's not factoring out it.
Let me put in another step. All right, this is the commutator of minus I over 2 sigma I with minus I over 2 sigma j. And, let's see, this is, minus a half I sigma I times minus a half I sigma j minus the other way around. Right, this would be minus a half I sigma j minus a half I sigma I. Right, so if I just pull out the minus a half from each one, I'm going to get a quarter. And what I'm left with is I sigma I
commutator with I sigma I, commutator I sigma j.
Okay.
And then I just use what I get up here. Any other questions? So the point is we have two different Lie groups here. I mean, one's a group of 2x2 matrices, one's a group of real 3x3 matrices. They both produce rotation. A rotation with the Pauli matrices, we looked at that when we looked at SL2C. We ended up exponentiating the I times the Pauli matrices and getting rotations. But you needed two factors of the transformation to get the rotation. The three-vector was actually written as some three-vector X dotted into the Pauli matrices. So these do rotations. So a rotation of a three-vector, a real three-vector X, is accomplished by setting the matrix X equal to X dot a Pauli matrix, and then we compute E to the some vector dot tau times X times the inverse E to the minus that vector dot tau. We do it by a similarity transformation of this matrix. And we show that this is some X prime. It'll still be, this is Hermitian, this will still be Hermitian, and it will be, we will have preserved the tracelessness of this. The components, you know, this can be written as some X prime dot sigma, in fact, and those X primes are the rotation of these X's. And I can assign you all sorts of examples to work out on that, to practice it on your own, if you like. But you're good. Now, what is the relationship between these two Lie groups, between SU2 and SO3? Well, in fact, it turns out that let's look at the manifold SU2. We looked extensively at SO3, and it is not simply connected because it was a ball. Remember, a three-dimensional ball of radius pi, and opposite points were identified. And if we had a curve that connected those two opposite points, if we try to move this one, the other one moves away. So we could not shrink that curve smoothly to zero. You know, if you just have a loop in the interior of the ball, you could just continuously deform it down to zero. But the group is not simply connected because of that identification of opposite points. Let's look at SU2. What is the manifold? Let's see. So we have E to the V dot tau, which we can write as, you know, if I let, this is a general element of SU2. It's writing very unevenly. Let's try another. Element of SU2. Then I can write V as some angle times the unit vector. And I can expand tau as minus 1/2 I times a Pauli matrix. So a general element can be written as E to the minus I phi over 2 n hat dot sigma. And if you've studied spin in quantum mechanics, you've seen that object. If you haven't studied spin in quantum mechanics, you probably haven't, but you will. This is how you act on, this is how you rotate a spinner. Right, a spinner is a little complex two-dimensional vector where the upper component is spin up in the z-direction and the lower component spin down in the z-direction. And a quantum state can be in one of those or a superposition of them. And that's all quantum mechanics, so, which we'll doubtless do sometime. But this operator is how you rotate them. Well, now, how many of these are there?
Three.
There's a three-dimensional set of these. Right, we have three real parameters.
So three factorial?
No, just count the number of real parameters in this expression. The segments are some six matrices, never mind the I over 2, but you have an angle phi and you have a direction n. And I promise you, if you work out this product for that, you'll find that this x prime here has been rotated about the direction n by an angle phi. The other two parameters are n hat. That's determined by two angles, some theta and alpha, say, so a direction on a sphere. If we want to know what manifold we're talking about, so it's a three-dimensional manifold, right? There are three real parameters. So what we've done is establish a map between grouped elements and R3, some subset of R3. What subset of R3? This gives us a two-sphere. And just like we did with the ball for SO3, we can treat this as a radius. We're just trying to find, what range, what subset of R3 the group labels span. So these cover every direction on a two-sphere. The radius, what's the range of the radius? Let phi equal 2 pi. What happens? If I put, g at, 2 pi for phi in some direction n, that's going to be e to the minus I pi n hat dot sigma. Well, what is that? Do you know this identity with the sine and cosine for this thing? Do you know that e to the, minus I phi over 2 n hat dot sigma is equal to the identity times the cosine of phi over 2 minus I n hat dot sigma sine phi over 2. Have you seen that before? Okay.
That's a modification of the Euler's.
Yeah, it sort of is. It works for similar reasons. Prove that identity. That's not hard. Okay, you're exponentiating a 2x2 matrix, and it's going to depend on powers of n hat dot sigma. Well, powers of n hat dot sigma are very simple. If you square it, you get 1. So if you cube it, you get n dot sigma again. So if you write out the power series, you can separate even and odd terms in the power series for the exponential. And one will give you sines and one will give you cosines. I mean, it's a simple problem. Don't labor too long over it, but ask if you get hung up. This is an identity that's very useful when you're doing spin, when you're working in quantum mechanics, if you're an engineer trying to do rotations. This is the way to do three-dimensional rotations. These things have very simple properties. They're they're closely related to the Cayley-Klein parameters. The Pauli matrices are essentially the Cayley-quaternions. Hamilton was very fond of quaternions as a way to do physics. These things have been around for a good century and a half at this point. Are actually very useful for a lot of purposes. So prove that identity. I'll just use it here. If I put in 2 pi, when pi equals 2 pi, e to the minus I over 2 pi n hat dot sigma is the identity times the cosine of pi minus I n hat dot sigma sine of pi. Well, sine of pi is 0, but cosine of pi is minus 1. We haven't come back after a 2 pi rotation. Have you guys seen the belt thing? Did I see the belt thing? You've seen the belt thing. Okay.
Belt thing?
The belt thing.
I don't think I saw
it. Did you see the belt thing? Where you took the belt? All right, belt thing. There's a belt. All right, we're going to twist it. Okay, half a turn, 1 turn. Okay, now I'm going to keep the orientation of this location and that. I'm going to keep that orientation. Move this around as much as I like, keeping that orientation. And I have I have a twisted belt. What did I do? Okay. Okay. How many turns is this? That's a rotation by 2 pi. And as long as I don't muck around with the orientation, I always have a rotation by 2 pi. What happened last time? What did I do? It can get worse, but it's not getting any better. If I go this way. Oh, there. Okay. So, pi rotation is a 2 pi rotation is 2 pi rotation. So I rotate by 2 pi. Now I rotate by 2 pi again. And now I am going to deform this thing around, keeping this orientation, and what am I doing? It's gone. Okay, a 4 pi rotation actually brings this thing back to a related topological configure. Okay, there's 4 pi. We bring it up and over like this, and bring it down, and the twist is gone. There. Got it that time.
So that's analog to spin 2?
That's an analog to spin 2, yeah. Spin 1/2 is what it's called, actually.
Spin 1/2?
Spin 1/2, yeah.
So you have to go around 4 pi before it's the same again.
You have to go around 4 pi, and that's true of these objects. Okay. So, yeah.
You can't just exponentiate and get a rotation in 3 space, right? R3.
I can exponentiate these to get a rotation.
Right, but this isn't a rotation, right?
This is not a rotation of
a vector.
A 3 vector.
Right.
It's a rotation of a 2 spinner. So if I have, let chi be a little complex two-dimensional vector, then chi prime is one of these. Acting on the old chi. That will give you the new chi. This is how spinners rotate. Spinners rotate with one factor of the matrix. So these things act on a two-dimensional complex vector space. And that two-dimensional complex vector space is realized in nature as electron spin, for example, or fermion spin. Spin 1/2. The 2 possible components of spin, this chi, I can think of this as linear combination of spin up and spin down. Okay, that's exactly what this thing is.
So when you do, you know, all these, you know, spin in the plus or minus z directions in quantum mechanics, you know, you're really looking at, you're looking directly at the two-dimensional complex space on which SU2 acts. And that is the natural place to do rotation. Because SU2 is the covering group, not SO3. SO2 is bigger. We've just seen that. SO3 is a sphere of radius pi. SU2 is a sphere of radius 2 pi. There are more transformations in SU2 than there are in SO3. And we can get them by taking a quotient by a finite subgroup. Let's continue.
Before you can... Can we talk about this notation?
The plus minus?
The brackets.
Do you remember the Stern-Gerlach experiment?
Let's see, is that running the electrons through a magnetic field?
Yeah. If you take cesium atoms, cesium atoms, is that CS? I think it's CS. Take a beam of cesium atoms. In cesium, the electron cloud is totally spherically symmetric. And all of the inner shells are filled up to, like, the N equal 4 level of, you know, what was, like, hydrogen, a hydrogenic atom. And then there's one extra electron that's not paired. So it's, you know, that puts it, I guess, in the first column of the periodic table or something, or somewhere near there. Versus the third. It's got this one outer electron in an s orbital. So the orbital of that electron is spherically symmetric too. But there's a magnetic moment to a cesium atom given by the spin of the electron, that single unpaired electron. And what happens is, in an inhomogeneous magnetic field, something with a magnetic moment feels a net up or down force, and so it doesn't bend out there, it bends when it's in here, and then you get two beams of cesium atoms out, this shows quantization, because what you would expect classically is sort of a Gaussian here, or, you know, some smear because of all of the possible orientations of that single electron spin. But in fact, it's quantized, and you only see two peaks, really sharp peaks here. And you call this spin up and spin down. You call them spin up and spin down, you draw them as little arrows, but if you take this to be the z axis, then these two states are either plus on the z axis or minus on the z axis. The magnitude, there's a spin operator in quantum mechanics as z, and it acts on these plus or minus states. Their eigenvalues, you get plus or minus Planck's constant over 2 for the magnitude of the spin, and it gives those two states back. So acting on plus, it gives plus, on minus, it gives minus. So the system is, after this experiment, it is in an eigenstate of that spin of the operator. And big surprise, this thing's proportional to a Pauli matrix. In the state, this is just sigma z plus 1 minus 1. Those are the eigenvalues. And so one more little thing connects with all the rest.
Okay, so, but the notation indicates
These are called kets. They're just components of vectors. It's just another way of writing a vector. In quantum mechanics, it's convenient to give yourself space in your vector notation to write a list of quantum numbers.
dependent to describe what particular kind of state it is. But in general, states in quantum mechanics are vectors, and this is just a way of writing a basis for certain vector space. Well, the vector space spanned by what you get out of certain gear lock devices. These are the devices that are used to tell time to 1 part in 10 to the 14th. Oh, let's not get off on that today.
Time really exists.
What's that?
Time really exists.
Does time really exist? Nope.
How can you tell it really exists?
It's an illusion that comes because of the way we're forced to make measurements in the world. But that, again, is another story. Well, it's not such a remote story. We'll get there. But okay. So, if you want to rotate one of these things, it's some complex two-dimensional rotation, these are the matrices you use. And if we let phi be 4 pi, what happens then is that e to the minus I over 2 4 pi n hat dot sigma is 1 times the cosine of 2 pi, and now we're very happy, minus I n hat dot sigma sine of 2 pi. Sine of 2 pi gives 0, and we end up with that at the identity. So we've accomplished a full possible rotation of the spin. And it's possible to check. In fact, it's not hard to check. It would be a good exercise to check that if I act with a general phi in some direction n on a two-component spinner like this, I can write out what I get for any n and phi. It's not too hard to see what this does to the little two-component alpha beta. And you can write that out as some other chi prime, some alpha prime and chi prime, or alpha prime and beta prime. And you'll see that chi never returns to its original value until you've gone through a rotation by 4 pi. Always requires that, no matter what chi you start with. And that would be a good exercise to do.
Is it called spin 1/2 just because of the ones that happen there?
It's called spin 1/2 because of the half in the eigenvalues of the spin operator. If you measure, the magnetic moment is assumed to be proportional to the spin angular momentum. And this operator is measuring the spin angular momentum in such a way that the magnetic moment of the electron dotted into the spin operator is the energy associated with the magnetic moment vector is proportional to the spin operator. And the energy of interaction is mu dotted into the magnetic field, minus mu dotted into the magnetic field gives you the energy of the interaction between the magnetic moment of the electron and this magnetic field. All right, that's what sets the physical magnitude of things. Now, a magnetic moment for a charged spinning thing is normally related to the angular momentum of the thing. And that's why you can relate. There's probably some constant here, but the constant is chosen so that if S is giving you the angular momentum, then mu is the magnetic moment. Well, it turns out that it's not possible to spin the charge of an electron fast enough to produce that magnetic field, but still, it acts as if it had that magnetic moment, and it fixes the constants here. Well, it turned out to be half of what you would expect from orbital angular momentum. Orbital angular momentum, so say for the electron around the proton, is quantized in integer multiples of Planck's constants. Right? But you can show that there exist representations of the rotation group that allow the eigenvalues to be half that much. You can do a full study of these commutation relations. And all of this is probably most cleanly seen by doing that. If you take this Lie algebra, you can construct some new operators, J plus and J minus, by taking a linear combination. This is a convenience. Plus or minus I, J. Why? JY. who gang? Text. AT&T free message. New dialing requirements begin March 1st. Why? It's got a camera on. Let's see.
You said about them changing the area code.
Are they? Is that what's happening?
I heard that they were. Oh. That might
okay.
be it.
All right. Well, these act like raising and lowering operators. And you can systematically construct all vector spaces on which operators satisfying these commutation relations, this Lie algebra, can possibly act. And what you find is that there is one vector space for each dimension on which these things connect. If it's one-dimensional, they don't do anything. You've got a scalar. If it's two-dimensional, you've got spin half. If it's three-dimensional, now you've got orbital angular momentum, spin one. And do a systematic study of all the possible kinds of angular momentum you can have. The number of states, all right, if you think back to quantum, the number of quantum states for an electron of orbital angular momentum L, remember L and M characterize the possible angular momentum states of an electron and hydrogen. And M runs from minus L up to 0, 1, up to plus L. And if you count those, there are 2L plus 1 possible orientations of the z-axis of orbital angular momentum in space. These are the possible quantized directions for that vector. Well, it actually comes out of group theory. What happens? Okay, 2L plus 1, notice that is any odd number you like. And that means that for a given L and M, for a given L, you're talking about a vector space of odd dimensions. And you can construct those possible angular momentum directions, and these operators will act on them quite happily with matrices of dimension 2L plus 1. But when you construct all vector spaces this can act on, you find every dimension, not just the odd ones. The even dimensions correspond to spin. And it's called spin 1 half because to S plus 1, you need S to be a half integer in order for this to come out to the dimension of the space. If S is 1 half, you get spin 2 because you're acting on a two-dimensional vector space. And to get 4, 6, 8, any even dimension, you need half-odd integer values of that parameter. So this is really where the half comes from. It's what you need the eigenvalues to be in order to use this formula that comes from angular momentum. It'd probably be a good thing to just run through all that sometime. You can find it. I bet Leboff does it. Most quantum books run through a pretty careful development of spin, at least at a certain level. I'll see if I can find a reference on that. trying to think who does it well. I'll take a look and see if I can find something you can read about that. So, little digression, but what we have now is a ball in three dimensions of radius, not pi, but 2 pi. Why 2 pi? Because we're going to run from minus 2 pi to plus 2 pi. Now,
so does that include everything, any integer value? Or
S does the half integer values.
Okay.
So,
including 0 and including negative?
Yeah, well, let's see. Now, 0, S runs 1 half, 3 half.
Oh.
Odd half integer. L runs 0, 1, 2, like that. So the values that spin angular momentum, that is a representation that FU2 can act on, have even dimensions, even numbers of possible states, whereas orbital angular momentum always gives you integer L and therefore always odd dimension states for vector representation. It's getting a little crowded here. Do you guys want to see more of this? Have you seen this before, Nathan?
A little.
Well, maybe I should run through constructing states from these operators. We can find, since they don't commute, you've got three operators, they don't commute. So you can diagonalize at most one of them, and we always diagonalize JZ. And the other thing you can show is that the sum of squares of the three operators, called J squared, J vector squared, commutes with all three.
Right.
And so you can label the vectors that these act on by two numbers, the eigenvalues of J squared and the eigenvalues of JZ. And it's as good as any other way of labeling. And then you find that this operator, these two operators, sort of, they don't change the values of JZ and, or sorry, they don't change the values of J squared, but they do change the values of JZ, and they sweep through integers just like this. From minus L to plus L, or minus S to plus S, they sweep through these values, and you just construct the what are called the irreducible representations of total angular momentum in that way. We can run through that if you want. Let me think about it for another time. But it's probably something that it wouldn't at all hurt to show you. Okay. I don't know. Would it be painful? You tell me.
Irreducible representations of
Total angular momentum. Okay. What about these funny topological identifications on this? We have a ball of radius 2 pi. If we get out to 2 pi, okay, yeah, actually, we can see it right here. Around any axis, a rotation by 4 pi is the identity. That means that, let me see, what does that mean? That does mean that opposite points are identified, but in fact, I'm trying to think what the best way to see this is. They're all identified with the identity. They're all the same point. Every point on the surface is the same point. So now, if we thread a curve through that ball to a point on the surface here and a point on the surface there, okay, that's a closed loop through the ball because opposite points are identified. But in fact, all points are identified, so I just bring the ends together, shrink it down to zero, and it's a simply connected space. So SU2 is simply connected. It is the covering group for the rotation group. And the things it acts on include all things that rotation can affect. Then it must be the case that SO3 is the quotient of SU2 by some two-dimensional subgroup. And in fact, the subgroup is plus or minus one. There's a 2-to-1 relationship between these two. There are two SU2 rotations for every one SO3. And it's not too hard to see that it's a 2-to-1 relationship. Let me just show you why. Actually, I've got the answer here, but let me write it again. So, remember, our x prime is some three-vector x dot sigma, and it's given by acting with e to the minus I phi over 2 n hat dot sigma on x, then e to the I phi over 2 n hat dot sigma. And what we see from this, notice that when phi is equal to 2 pi, we have a minus 1 here. What does minus 1 do here? At phi equals 2 pi, this thing is minus 1. And at phi equals 2 pi, this thing is minus 1. So the net effect at 2 pi is this x. So x comes back to itself after a 2 pi rotation. Well, we knew that. But we see it directly here. In general,
is that the x is three vector?
This is a three vector dotted into the polys, so it's a trace of Hermitian matrix.
Okay.
In general, plus or minus e to the I phi over two n hat dot sigma both give the same rotation. They do the same thing as x.
So x not six.
Right, and that's obvious because a sine, since there are two of these, the sine's not going to do anything. The sine will just cancel. So we quotient by that factor of two, and we get SO3. So basically, the quotient is we take SU2 and V2 is the name for the two element group. That is, we're looking at, let's see, what are the cosets? The cosets, GV2, are sets containing some G times each element of V2. Well, it's just plus e to the I phi over 2 n dot sigma and minus e to the I phi n dot 2 over sigma. So we regard those two objects as the same in SU2, and we get SO3. That gives one, there is exactly one coset for each element of SO3 and for each rotation of this matrix X. And you can see that must be the case, because the only difference between these two is the sign. Clearly, these two give the same transformation of X. If you want to go through and prove that, except for that, all the transformations are the same, feel free. That would take a little bit of fussing around with matrices. There we go. So this is an example of a covering group and quotient by a discrete subgroup. And Let's see.
On this, on the second time that you have the polymatrices, the first one, was it 2 pi? And the second one, are you evaluating the second one too?
What?
Down a little bit further. That one's at 2 pi.
Oh, yeah, at 2 pi. Both of these being minus 1 just gives me x back. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, and then the next case.
Oh,
in general, you say.
There's
not being evaluated.
There are always two things here that give me the same thing. In fact, let's see, what would they be if I. I 5 plus 2 pi over 2, e to that, n hat dot sigma. Let's see. It might be that simple. So check me on this. But I think that's going to be minus e to the I 5 over 2 n hat dot sigma. So that's my conjecture about what happens in general. But rotating by phi and by phi plus 2 pi gives you the same matrix except for a sign. So these two transformations, e to the I 5 over 2 n dot sigma and this one, which is just a minus sign, will give you the same x every time, because the two minus signs cancel. It almost has to be 5 plus 2 pi, I'm sure that's right, just use this identity here. If I put in, let's just check it. So for any group element, G equals E, I phi over 2, n dot sigma. That's G at phi and n hat. G at phi plus 2 pi and n hat is E to the I phi over 2, n hat dot sigma. And the identity you're going to prove, the phi plus 2 pi, n hat dot sigma. And now we use our identity up here, so we have 1 times the cosine of 5 plus 2 pi over 2. So we get phi over 2 plus pi plus in this case, I n hat dot sigma sine of phi over 2 plus pi. And the cosine or sine of phi over 2 plus pi is just minus the cosine of the sine. So this comes out to minus 1 cos phi over 2 plus minus I n hat dot sigma sine phi over 2, which is just minus 1 times g of phi and n hat. So there we have the proof that for every g of phi n hat, there is another transformation, namely g of phi plus 2 pi n hat, that gives the same transformation up to a sine and therefore has the same property of leaving x unchanged. Those two transformations, I'm sorry, they don't leave x unchanged, they give the same x prime. So these two group elements give the same x prime from a given x, from any given x.
So do they rotate?
They both rotate it by phi.
Oh, okay.
Right? That's it. They both rotate it by phi. The sine goes away. Right? Acting on this matrix X, we're doing a similarity transformation, so an overall sine on both those elements goes away.
So that's the V2 in FU2 that we quotient by to get SO3.
It's easy to see that it's a subgroup. It's a group. It's just a Boolean group again. And you could look at, for every G, there's a minus G. So it clearly is a subset of FU2. And you just have to show that it forms a group. Questions? How are we doing? We got more into this than I expected. We can keep going here for a while. Your question, Ian?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think. So the SO3 takes only one rotation.
Yeah.
For SO2, you make two rotations.
Yeah. That's true of vectors and matrices in general. All right. Think of general relativity. A rank n tensor requires n factors of the transformation matrix to transform it. So, for a vector representation, you act with one transformation matrix to transform it. But it turns out that a three vector represented in FU2, under the action of FU2, is a matrix. So, we know how to act on this if we write it as a matrix. And since it's a matrix, it's going to require rank two tensor under FU2. It's going to require two transformation matrices to transform it. And, this raises another point. When we're talking about general relativity, we talked about tensors. Tensors are with respect to a specific group. Okay? Tensors are the things that some specific transformation group acts on linearly and homogeneously. What we're talking about here are the tensors of FU2. What object does FU2 act on linearly and homogeneously? Well, it acts on little complex two vectors. It acts on complex 2x2 matrices. It can act on rank three tensors, 2x2x2 objects, and so on. You can construct all sorts of higher order tensors on which FU2 acts multilinearly and homogeneously. So that's what these representations are. All right, they're the things these groups can act on. So we can construct tensors with respect to any group we like, any transformation group we want.
But with all of the 2x2s, right? It says
any 2x2 will transform into another 2x2. Since 2x2 is a matrix, so it requires two group operations to transform it into the new one. Alright, remember when we had rank two tensors? What rank two tensors did? The metric, G mu nu. If we want to know what happens to G mu nu under a general coordinate transformation, we multiply by dx nu dy alpha dx nu dy beta to get G prime, of y here. That'll be alpha beta. Okay, linear homogeneous. What's that?
The Jacobian.
No, the Jacobian matrix.
Right.
The transformation matrix, the general coordinate transformation. So, G is a tensor under general linear transformations, where now this thing is the transformation matrix. Well, X is a second rank tensor under FU2 transformation. Transforms as a matrix. Two copies of the group. This is an element of the group, that's an element of the group. This is a big group, different work, huge group, but a good group. Let's see. I had thought when I came in, the next thing I was going to show you was about normal subgroups, not the discrete subgroups. I'm glad that you're...
About what you just said.
Okay.
The diffeomorphisms form a group.
Yeah. it's the fancy name for coordinate transformation.
Oh, okay.
people who think about this sort of thing too much like to think of moving the points of the manifold around instead of just renaming them, and it's just an active versus passive transformation. You can think of rotations as moving a vector from here to there, or rotating the space and leaving the vector fixed. It's just like the Heisenberg versus Schrodinger picture in quantum mechanics. Schrodinger leaves the operators fixed and moves the state vector around as psi as a function of time. Heisenberg moves the operators and leaves the state fixed. They do the same thing. It's the relative change that's important. And so the diffeomorphism group, it's a group of coordinate transformations. Diffeomorphisms refers to the fact that they're differentiable transformations. So you specify some order of differentiability for these transformations. Usually you take them smooth, but you don't have to. And so the group of differentiable coordinate transformations, I suppose, might be a way to say it. Oh, I see so many questions lurking. go ahead, ask away.
In this last expression here, which is the covering group?
Fe2. This group is the set minus 1 and plus 1, and the operation is normal multiplication. Okay, so plus or minus 1 under multiplication gives us a group. We looked at that as the first group we looked at. And that's a subgroup of Fe2. If I take the quotient by that two-element subgroup, so for every element of this, I'm taking two of the elements and I'm calling them the same thing. So I'm going to identify all elements of a coset. Well, it's just plus a group element and minus a group element. Then then the set of all these cosets, well, how many are there? There are half as many of these as there were in Fe2. There are still a lot of half as many because that's divided by 2 in a group sense. Again, SO3. There's one of these sets for every element of SO3. And it's easy to see then that taking either one of these, doesn't matter which, and acting on X gives us a unique X prime for each. For each unique pair, I get a unique X prime. So, we could burn through that. It would work.
What do similarity transformations do in general for you?
What do which?
Similarity?
A similarity transformation is what you get from a... if you have an operator acting on a vector to give another vector, what you get is a similarity. So suppose I have some transformation matrix and it's going to act on some vector B to give me some new vector U. That's not the transformation. Some operator, some matrix acting on B to give U. So, Mij, Bj is Ui. Now suppose I have some transformation of the vector space B. So if I have some transformation matrix of B that gives me a V tilde, right? So, maybe this is a dynamical equation, F equals ma or some angular momentum thing or whatever, any kind of, let's see, how do I want to say this? Just some linear equation on that vector space. If I act on this with T, so I can act with T on M acting on V, and that's the same as T acting on U. Well, T acting on U is just U tilde. U vector, tilde vector, vector tilde. But this is not M acting on V tilde, it's T acting on MV. What I can do is stick in an identity in the form of T inverse T on V, and then I can recognize some matrix M, TMT inverse acting on V tilde. So that leads me to identify M tilde, a new form of the operator, as what I get by a similarity transformation of my original matrix. So it's a similarity is the kind of transformation that preserves matrix equations or matrix operations on vectors. That's one way to think of it. Another way to think of it is as the way grouped elements act on second rank tensors. Okay, we know that you want to act with a group on each index of your tensor. So if you have a rank n tensor, it's going to take n group elements to transform it. So having digested that, you know, you build that up from outer products of vectors, right? You can derive that directly. So a rank 2 object is going to require two transformations. The similarity comes in because, in fact, this kind of a transformation, M is generally, you know, if you want to multiply a vector by a matrix and get a vector, M is this mixed rank, it's type 1-1, which frequently exists within a group. You know, if there's some metric, a group invariant metric, then you'll make that distinction. And then M won't transform with two copies of the group. It'll have one group transformation and one inverse transformation.
Okay, I'm worried about that. Yeah, when that line of thinking appears, you'll have that line.
I don't
need it here. These are both. This is doubly covariant.
Right. Okay.
Here we do have it. That's the inverse to that.
Right. Vice versa. Okay. Okay. That makes more sense.
So. Lots of different things. Nathan, did you have a question?
It looks like you were working on one there.
Oh, no, I was thinking about what you're doing.
Okay.
Well, so when I make the rotation and goes from the F03 group, it's taking the final bundle, like I said. It originates on the origin, goes through the F03 group, and it goes out to F02.
So you can think of a copy of SO3 sitting inside SU2,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you know, you get out to pi and you run through a second copy of SO3 before you get out to 2 pi.
Oh.
That's just right. Yeah, and it's exactly the identification we made here. Remember where I just erased it, that 5 plus 2 pi. So, you know, that's going out 2 pi. So from any element in the inner part of the ball, if I go out, let's see, that was by 2 pi. Where does that take me? Going out by 2 pi, that's if I go out by pi, if I keep going out, where am I going to get to? I've confused myself. Yeah, to get the equivalent one, we added 2 pi to phi. And, let's see, that,
I'm trying to think whether that corresponds to going out to the surface and coming in from the other side.
Yeah, that's what you
Yeah, it probably does. You'd want to look at, okay, you've got a rotation by something around a given axis.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, by the time I rotate by 2 pi, that puts me at the outer boundary of the sphere. Okay, what if I keep turning? Where am I? Well, that point is the same as this one down here. So it's quite possible it's the same as looking at the opposite direction of vector and moving in. That seems likely. So I may start coming in from the other side. See, Neil? Coming in from the other side of the sphere. So if I'm between 0 and pi, and I go out by pi, now I'm out here short of the boundary, and I've moved by pi. Now I move by another pi, and I'm coming into the sphere on the other side. So, yeah, that works. That would put me in that second shell. That depends on a particular view of how we've embedded this thing in our tree. We could probably do it from 0 to 2 pi, 0 to 4 pi somewhere. And get it to work out, too. And then we could just keep going the same direction.
This very last line is stumping me a little bit. Why don't the T inverse and the T cancel each other out?
Oh, they did. I meant to stick them in. I'm sticking an identity in here, and I'm writing that identity as T inverse T.
And then how does the T act on this vector?
Oh, that was the original transformation here.
Oh, okay.
Right, so I know what this is, so I want to group this thing this way. So this operator is the one that acts on V tilde to give U tilde.
Oh.
So I'm going to call it M tilde.
I think okay.
Yeah. So, I've got two things. I've got some kind of transformation that takes me from untilded to tilded vectors, and I've got some physical law that says act with M on V and I get U. What I want to know is what do I act on V tilde with to get U tilde? That's the question, and the answer is this thing. A similarity transformation of M.
So it's our operator.
Yeah.
It has the same dimension as it needs to.
Yeah, this is some n-dimensional. This is an n by n matrix acting on some n-dimensional vector. Sure, could be three dimensions. That's fine. But the question was about why you get this similarity thing. It comes from sticking in that identity there and, making it happen. But it's just that question. What do I have to act on V tilde with to get U tilde if M on V gives me U? Should we do normal subgroups? Or maybe you have more questions on this stuff. I don't know. This turned into a lot. So nobody knows. Everybody's busy writing, computing, thinking. Yeah, we could try and construct the states. That'd be more along the same lines. Should we do that?
Well, we
could look at everything that these J's act on. Can make all find all those irreducible representations. Would you like to see that?
We could probably figure out how to do it. It's not quite the change of pace that, you know, doing a normal subgroup is sort of going back to group theory type proof, which might be a refreshing change of pace, or might be just some whole other thing to try and wrestle with.
Can you tell me the notation of the what this means to J plus minus, the plus minus of?
Oh, I'm defining two operators.
For both J,
J plus
and
J minus.
Oh, okay.
J minus
is just
is the difference there.
Okay.
Economy of marker. Yeah.
So those two operate on a spin vector and give them their spin vector, sort of thing.
Oh, shall we just do it?
Okay.
All right. Let's find all the things that. Okay. Suppose we have a set of things that can that satisfy this commutation relation. The question is to find. All of the representations of that. Find all vector spaces on which such operators could act. And we, to do that, we need to be systematic about it. So let's suppose. Oh, do you have to go 2-1?
I have a lot of
okay.
So, oh, we've got our copy of things like return.
Yeah. I don't know. Should we do this? Should we save this for another time? Okay. All right. We'll set that up.
I asked Neil when he was right out the door, and his best time to do that would be Friday before class.
Friday before class. Okay.
Yeah. And his schedule is seemingly pretty jammed. He didn't.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's meet, you know, between...
I think I can make progress,
Okay, good. Yeah, try as many of those problems as you can.
Yeah.
You know, you'll start getting the hang of it pretty quickly. You know, you've got to, you know, grind a little on the first couple of...
That I can use as someplace to...
Good. Nathan was saying that, you know, by the time he got through all those examples in that last problem, you know, he's starting to feel pretty good about doing these operations.
Yeah, it gets better.
You know, it's a pretty quick learning curve on it, I think. You know, you'll get it. But, okay, Friday, let's see. You know, I grab lunch and then I get back over here sometime between 2:15. I think I got here, you know, like 2:10 today, something like that. And I'm available from then on, so just catch me at my office and so let's do that Friday.
I'll plan on that on Friday, and I'll remind Neil that we're shooting for that time.
Okay. And Juan, we're meeting at 10:30 on Friday. It's going to be a long day. Okay. I may get to class and just be too tired to do anything. We'll see. Okay, good. Any more questions then?
Paul, looks like you need to be trying to spin.
Yeah.
I heard you can change the spin of one electron. It automatically changes another spin of another electron in the same orbital, right?
Oh, yeah, if you flip one, yeah, because they've got to stay opposite because of the exclusion principle.
Right. The problem, though, is like I heard, like, if you, that information, between you change one spin, the information that transfers from one electron to the other electron can more be faster than you like.
Well, yeah, people talk about that a lot. Electrons are indistinguishable, so you don't really know which electron was see one was spin up and spin down. You know, these kinds of experiments are correlated measurement experiments. It gets more dramatic if you say you have a particle decay into an electron-positron pair. A spin-zero particle decay into a electron-positron pair, then the spins of those are anti-correlated because you have to conserve angular momentum. So if this would spin up, that's got to be down, and vice versa. So now you measure this one, and boom, you now know what that one is, even though this one is, you know, light years away by now,
mm-hmm.
If you've waited years and managed to keep it in vacuum. well, fine, but unless you can control the outcome of this measurement, you haven't conveyed any information, and certainly no energy has passed from here to here. My sense of this is people get very confused about the instantaneous things that occur in quantum physics. I get around that by thinking of the quantum state as a list of all things potentially knowable about the system. So it's potentially knowable that the spin is up, it's potentially knowable that the spin is down, and so on, and, you know, the momentum is this, and the position is that, and so on. So there's this list.
And it doesn't matter when such things get defined.
Right. You know, well, we know about this, so we produce the system somehow, so we now there's a list. Now we measure some property of this. Oops, well, the list is different now. What do you know? Instantaneously, I made a measurement, and the list is different. I haven't conveyed any information anywhere. I haven't, you know, sent any signal anywhere. Now,
the states were entangled.
The distant states were entangled, and so it does have consequences for what can be measured over here. So if I measure spin up, I know that he's going to measure spin down. Now, if you can think of a way that I can send him a secret message doing that, great. But, you know, since until one of us makes a measurement, you know, the state is still a superposition state of equal parts of spin up and spin down.
Why do people get C mixed up in that argument?
Well, people call this the collapse of the wave function, and it happens instantaneously. You know, as soon as you make the measurement here, all right, any state in the rest of the universe that this is entangled with is suddenly changed as well. So this remote positron.
Can you change the state here?
Yeah, I can't.
It's part of the list.
I can't say, oh, this is up, and flip it over and say it's down, so now yours is up. No, by moving it, I've broken the coherence. I've broken the entanglement if I actually do something on this. Measuring what it, you know, what it is, also tells me what the remote one is. But until I measure this one, I don't know anything about that one either, and I can't control what I'm going to measure here. So I don't see how this kind of thing can be used to, you know, actually convey information. You know, faster than the speed of light is, you know, magic words, but, you know, it's not happening. I think that the collapse of the wave function is actually a gauge choice in a gauge theory. Okay, for example, we're studying some system, we make a measurement of an electron. What's the mass of the electron? Well, it's, you know, 511 MeV, right? Why? Well, because we define all electrons to have the same mass. What if they don't? How would we know? Two electrons are never at the same place. You know, what if that mass is changing? You know, well, we've got to compare to a standard. Well, what's the standard? Well, the standard is the electron mass, you know. By choosing the mass of all electrons to be 511 MeV, you know, that sets a scale. If we don't say that, you know, we could choose some other thing to be the same all the time. You know, we choose all electrons. Well, it's a different thing, but say we chose all electrons to always have to spin up. What have we done? We've just defined our z-axis everywhere. You know, we're free to do that. You know, what are you defining and what are you measuring? You know, what sets your standard? And,
you know, what are you actually, what information you're actually getting. So I think when we make a measurement, we have certain pre-expectations that force us, you know, it's quite possible that the mass of the electron is changing. In fact, you can choose units where it does, you know, choose, you know, kilograms now and grams tomorrow. Fine, you know, the numerical value of the mass is different. If in fact the mass of the electron is time dependent, well, no two electrons are ever at the same place, so, you know, at any given time, we can choose the mass of all electrons to be any function we want, and we'll have no contradiction. It's a good way to choose a gauge, you know, one for each point.
But some have kinetic energy, and some are going to be...
Okay, so now let's measure the mass and the energy of these electrons. All right, now both of these things scale. Those two aren't independent. They're both measured in units of inverse length, actually. If you use h bar and c enough, mass is an inverse length. You know, what? Mc over h bar is 1 over length dimensionally. So if all your lengths are changing as things evolve, then... you make a measurement of this electron and you measure the energy. You don't bother to measure the mass because you're assuming the mass is the same. That's a gauge choice. That mass may not be the same. So by assuming it's the same, you force an instantaneous new gauge choice at this later time. It happens right now. You do a gauge transformation, you know, okay. After this time, we're in a new gauge everywhere. You know, you're doing the calculation, you do it everywhere at once, right? So your choice of gauge suddenly renormalizes everything everywhere. We're now working in a gauge where the mass, there's an electron here and it has the mass that I've always assumed for an electron. So I've locked it down at that later time, as soon as I start measuring things about it, just by my assumption. Well, it's a very convenient assumption to assume the electrons all have the same mass, but, you know, we could assume they all have the same energy, and that would be different. If we assume they all have the same energy, then they'd have different masses.
So you're basically taking assumptions of one situation and bringing that to another situation, and using that to bring on your own measurement, but you're forgetting that the fact that your assumption
So I think this thing people call the collapse of the wave function is this sort of gauge choice, you know, this sort of implicit assumption that we make about, you know, values staying the same. So we're constantly setting new gauges. Every time we take a measurement, we're setting a new gauge. Therefore, we're suddenly changing the numerical values of everything, everywhere, at that moment. No mystery.
So you're saying you should be more specific about the measurements, like you should measure the mass, whatever, measure all the properties we need, and use that as a basis for our future measurements.
Well, okay, any measurement's a comparison.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and so we have to take into account the standard. Well, so now we take two particles and we want to track the mass of this one. Well, what we're going to do is compare it to the mass of that one. And, you know, we bring them back together and compare the masses at this later time. What we do is we evolve the quantum wave function of this one, and we evolve the quantum wave function of that one.
Mm-hmm.
They're identical particles. We take the ratio of those magnitudes, but since they're, you know, basically complex phases, it amounts to multiplying psi times its conjugate, and that's the probability density. It involves both the thing and the standard, and I think this is why in quantum mechanics we multiply psi times its conjugate, and psi is an amplitude. It's not a measurable probability. You have to multiply it by your representation of the standard
compare it to the standard before you can get a meaningful number that's capable of being measured. And I think this is why we should probably put the answer to. Yeah, I think so. You know, we wrote a paper on this. It worked. Yeah. Very nice theory, quantum scanning.
I'm going to run off and see if I can catch that key. Human resources. Okay.
So I'll see you right after I get back here from lunch on Friday.
On Friday, yeah.
So I'll see you Wednesday. Do we have a slope in tomorrow?
I did see a note on that last week. I don't remember what it is, though.
I've got an email on it. I'll check it. Where'd Juan go? Juan left his own nuts. Do you know how to turn this off?
That would be a funny last transcription.
Lock. No, that lock.
Is there a red button?
There's a button with a red circle.